Welcome to the Graduate Institute In Conversation With podcast series. I'm Lena Menge, Outreach Officer at the Graduate Institute. In this series, we ask renowned expert and thought leaders to address pressing global issues with a Graduate Institute faculty member. This episode features a discussion with José Manuel Barroso, former President of the European Commission, former Prime Minister of Portugal, and visiting professor at the Graduate Institute, and Erika Moret, Senior Researcher and Adjunct Professor in International Relations and Political Science at the Graduate Institute. This discussion focuses on the European Union's policy response and geopolitical challenges and opportunities presented by the crisis.
It's my great pleasure to welcome José Manuel Barroso with us here today. Welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be talking today about the COVID-19 crisis in Europe. As a continent, we're among the hardest hit in the world here, of course. Untold lives have been lost, families in grieving, immeasurable economic damage. How is Europe faring in this pandemic compared to the rest of the world, in your view?
First of all, we have to acknowledge that Europe was for some time the epicenter of this pandemic. This pandemic originated in Asia, in fact in China, and Europe was badly affected. But it's also fair to say that now the pandemic is, the peak of the pandemic in Europe seems to be behind us, while for the world, we can say the peak is still ahead of us. That's the opinion of the World Health Organization. So apparently, we are now in a better situation in Europe from a health point of view. Of course, we should avoid any form of complacency. But we have also to consider now the extremely high impact from an economic and social point of view. And from that point of view, I think that Europe has been responding in a satisfactory or even in a very positive way.
Yeah, I think, thank you. You have, of course, been at the helm, both in your home country, Portugal, and later in the EU, through some extremely difficult and challenging times. But I guess none have been quite like this one. So you've mentioned a bit of an overview, but what do you think about the political responses to the crisis in the EU in general, particularly in light of your own dealings with a really major crisis in 2000 and 2008 in terms of the global economic crisis and some of the other big challenges that you've seen over the years?
I think this is by far the biggest crisis I've seen, at least in my lifetime, in economic terms, no doubts about it. This is going to be a deeper recession than the one we had in 2008 and the following years, according to all forecasts from the European Commission, from the IMF, so from the other, let's say, international, very competent agencies. Probably we can only compare with the crisis of the 30s, the 20th century, but it is going to be the biggest, at least since the Second World War. Now, it's different from the previous crisis, namely the one I know well because I was at that time leading the European Commission, the great financial crisis, because it's possible that the rebound takes place in a more determined way and sooner than the last crisis. But in terms of recession figures and employment growth, certainly, at least in the United States, Europe, it will be much bigger than the previous crisis. Now, from a political point of view, I think there are good news. This time, the European leaders and the European institutions were able to react in a more strong and decisive and quick way, probably because there was also the lessons learned from the previous crisis. As you remember, during the financial crisis, it took more or less 4 years for the European Central Bank to commit to the so-called whatever it takes policy announced by President Mario Draghi. Now it took less than 4 weeks because some taboos were broken. I'm not criticizing the European Central Bank what they have done or not done before. At that time, there were not yet the conditions because we were in a completely new territory to take some measures, and the European Central Bank could not take those measures without having in place some kind of framework that should be approved before by the member states. And now, in fact, we created, for instance, the EFSF, European Financial Stability facility, and then the European Stability Mechanism. The governments of the euro area committed to some measures in terms of governance of the euro area, and then the ECB felt it could commit to some unorthodox measures. So this time, the ECB announced very early the so-called no limits policy, and so it is important to accept that at this time there was broader support for a determined action at European level besides the measures announced at a national level. And as you know, the Eurogroup, afterwards confirmed by the European Council, also adopted a very important package of 540 billion euros that are already available to support workers, namely through a program created by the European Commission, to support business, namely through a program of the European Investment Bank, and to support the sovereign, support governments through the European Stability Mechanism. And now, there is on the table a proposal of the European Commission, 750 billion euros, most probably two-thirds of it in the form of grants, not loans. So two-thirds grants, one-third loans, and that comes in on top of a strong commitment announced by France and Germany, by Chancellor Merkel, President Macron, also of support to this kind of action, including some forms of debt mutualization, what I call the soft mutualization of debt. And this, once again, is another taboo that is broken. So now, of course, this is not yet fully approved. It's still controversial. But I believe, from what I see and what I know from different governments, that at the end there will be a consensus, a compromise, as always in Europe. Those compromises take time. They are typically not at the highest level of ambition. So I think probably we are going to have some conditions attached to this program. Probably the amounts are not going to be the precise ones. But I think it will be, nevertheless, a very ambitious package that now, under, by the way, the leadership of Germany, because I think Germany is now playing a very important role, Chancellor Merkel especially, and they have now the rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union. I think that with that commitment, it's possible, at least it's desirable, that this package will be approved not later than this summer. And so it will enable the European Union to have all these programs in place for next year, linking it to the seven-year budget. So very ambitious. Once again, I think the European Union is demonstrating a point that I've been making for many years based on my experience, resilience, I think. And I'm no longer in public office now. I'm no longer in politics. I speak with complete independence. I really believe that the European Union has a resilience that is higher than most observers typically acknowledge.
Do you think that Europe's actually doing enough to engage with other parts of the world, other countries, other regional organizations, and so on? Because, of course, Europe's recovery is only going to be as good as what goes on in the wider world, not only in economic terms, but also in terms of ability to tackle the crisis effectively, political relations. So what do you think about that? Is Europe doing, is the EU and wider Europe doing enough to engage appropriately with other partners around the world?
That's a very important point. And in fact, I will try to respond to it more generally. I think this time, this is not happening as it should. If I compare this crisis to the previous crisis, great financial crisis, in fact, there was a stronger commitment of the so-called international community. I like to remind you that it was, in fact, a European Union initiative. It was myself and the present, then rotating president of the Council, Sarkozy, President Sarkozy from France. We went to speak with President George W. Bush in Camp David, to tell him or to ask him to organize some kind of global initiative with us, because it was for us evident that in face of that financial crisis, the G8, at that time we had the G8, Russia was still a member of G8, the G8 will not be sufficient. We needed to have China, India, Brazil, other countries, Korea, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, other countries from all over the world that are important for the global economy to respond. The United Nations on its own could not be giving an answer, because, I mean, we could not expect, let's say, a consensus between, let's say, the United States, Iran, North Korea, and so on. But we should have most of the global economy united. And then we had, in fact, to be frank, at that time, President Bush was not enthusiastic about the idea, because it would be putting a lot of spotlight on the American position. And in fact, the last financial crisis started, as we remember well, with the financial crisis in the United States, namely the famous collapse of Lehman Brothers. So at that time, he was quite reluctant, but then he understood and he supported very much that idea. And so we organized in Washington the first G20 at heads of state, heads of government level. It was the first G20, end of 2008, and then the second one was in London, and the third one was already with the presidency of Obama. Took place in Pittsburgh, in the United States. And since then, the G20 established itself as the major economic forum globally. Having said that, it's true that nowadays the G20 is not as efficient. There is a lack of, let's say, cooperation between some of the members, namely the United States and China. This is well known. And at that time, I will not say that the response was perfect, but at least we have avoided a return to protectionism. That was one of our first concerns. And there was a commitment to same joint effort to restore, let's say, growth in global economy. And there were some interesting initiatives like the fight against tax evasion and tax fraud. And together with the OECD, we have done some progress in that direction. So at that time, there was a high level of willingness. I participated in all those meetings until I left the Commission in 2014. And I can tell you, of course, very important differences. But basically, there was a real commitment between the three most important poles of the global economy. They are Europe, European Union, United States, and China. This time, the situation is different. There is going on, in fact, a very important, let's say, geopolitical, how can I put, tensions between the United States and China. And this is, of course, making things more complex. The European Union, of course, is committed to a multilateral approach and to a multilateral order. I believe the European Union is very committed to that. But, of course, it cannot do it on its own if others are not ready. And by the way, I think one of the trends of this COVID crisis, is that we are seeing the deepening and widening, the acceleration of trends that we have seen before. And one of them being a kind of a more, some deglobalization, if I may use the word deglobalization. I'm not sure that we are going to see full reverse of or the globalization coming to a full reverse mode. I'm not saying that. But for me, it's quite clear that we are seeing also economically, we are already seeing a weakening of global trade. We are seeing some onshoring, some relocalization of the so-called supply chains. And Europe, of course, is part of it. But that was a trend before. Let's not forget it was already the European Union in 2019, following a document, a communication by the European Commission and with the High Representative, that stated that China was a systemic rival. It was not only a cooperation partner, but also an economic competitor and a systemic rival. So, and now all these trends are accelerating, and that explains probably why we don't have the level of cooperation that I think would be good to have. And specifically, we have seen what happened to the WTO with the United States basically stopping its activity because of non-nomination of judges for the appellate body. Also, now the United States announcing that they leave the World Health Organization. Of course, this is extremely detrimental because basically, let's be honest about this. I mean, we are living in an order, a global order that was basically created by the United States or by the West after the Second World War. For some reason, the United Nations headquarters are in New York. The World Bank or the IMF headquarters are in Washington. They are not in Beijing or in Moscow, not in Brussels or not in Latin America or Africa. And what happens now is that the country that was, let's say, the most important stakeholder in this order appears, with the current administration, not really committed to this global order or multilateral approach. And this, of course, puts the European Union in a difficult position. The reaction so far has been trying to keep its commitment, but of course, it has to be done in a much more difficult environment.
Yeah, looking further afield, I mean, as you said, there was, of course, already a mounting and very serious crisis in multilateralism and global governance. And I think what we probably will be seeing, as you're implying, is that there will be various ramifications of this accelerated through the pandemic. And we probably can't really predict yet what these impacts will be. But what I see in my own work is that tackling all forms of global security challenges, foreign policy challenges, and also, of course, pandemics requires cross-border collaboration. We've just heard the President Trump's announcement over the intention to fully withdraw from the World Health Organization. So do you think that Europe then should be playing a very active role once again, like you did with Nicolas Sarkozy in the past, in keeping global governance alive, perhaps in some kind of a bridging role between the US and China? Is there scope for that in today's political climate?
I think the European Union has certainly that intention. I have no doubts that is, I would say topologically, if I may use the word, the position in which the European Union wants to be. So, of course, when it comes to United States and China, it's difficult for the European Union because the United States are by far the most important partner of Europe. And it continues to be by far the biggest economic relationship in the world, Europe, United States, both in terms of trade and investment, but also politically and in security terms. Most members of NATO are European Union members. Most members of the European Union are members of NATO. So with a global security guarantee given by the United States, basically. So on the other side, China is an extremely important economic partner as well. And Europe is more dependent on trade than the United States. And some, including, by the way, the economic powerhouse of Europe, that is, I mean, certainly Germany, it's critically important for Germany to keep the Chinese markets open. So that's why the European Union, and I use the word topologically, is somewhere in between. But my opinion is if one day Europe had to make a choice, it will certainly choose to remain with the United States. Of course, it's difficult to say with the current administration because, to be very frank about it, it's a little bit strange. Mike Pompeo calls all the foreign ministers of Europe, asking them to act in a coordinated manner with the United States concerning China. And the following day, President Trump says that probably more difficult for the United States than China, it is Europe and the European Union and Germany. So it's a little bit difficult to understand what exactly is the orientation from Washington concerning the European Union. Because typically, there were always differences, but typically the Americans have been supporting European integration. In fact, the European community started to a large extent with strong support by the United States, including the very idea of European integration. In fact, to some extent, the Marshall Plan was at the origin of the European community. And we've seen with different administrations, probably different levels of commitment, but a strong transatlantic relationship. Today, we are probably the most difficult moment of transatlantic relationship since the creation of the Atlantic Community. And this is of course, a difficulty. So this is why the European Union remains committed to multilateralism. But we have to say that on the other side of the Atlantic, we don't see the same thing. That's why probably in Europe, most leaders are waiting to see what happens in the elections in the end of this year in the United States. While I believe personally that the difficult relationship between China and the United States is going to continue, and that situation can only go worse from my point of view. I've been saying that, by the way, for already some time. I believe that there are more opportunities for cooperation with the United States with another administration. That is, for me, quite obvious. Having said that, European Union can and should do more in global terms. But I think that's exactly what the European institutions are trying to do. But at the end, of course, we need all the member states to commit to this approach.
Just turning inward to Europe slightly more now, you mentioned this kind of idea of reverse protectionism. And there have been, of course, some cases in the EU between member states of countries being seen to pitch against one each other in terms of things like medical supplies and so on. And we're also seeing this between the US and Canada and the US and Europe. So a kind of lack of solidarity at certain times in an attempt to tackle the virus together. So how would you recommend, because of course you have a great deal of experience on this level, how would you recommend that the EU member states remain together as one, should pull together at this difficult time and be able to look outwards and inwards at the same time in terms of priorities?
No, you're completely right. In fact, in times of crisis, very often we have to be realistic about it. The first, let's say, instinct, the first the reaction is one of closing to others, closing in the, inside the European Union, different countries took some measures, but also globally. And that was, I don't think it was the right direction. By the way, it's not rational at the end of the day, because we are in the same boat. And when we are in the same boat, we cannot say your side of the boat is sinking. I mean, it's also an illusion from the so-called developed world to think that now we can, if we can find a vaccine, things are going to be over. It's a complete mistake. We, as I said before, the peak of this pandemic is still ahead of us. If you look at some of the developing world and emerging economies, if you look at Latin America, for instance, it's rising. The number of infections is rising. The number of casualties is rising. So, and we are in a world where a lot of interaction exists. So that's why it's not so much, not only because of solidarity, that of course, from an ethical point of view, we'd like to see stronger commitment to solidarity at all levels, and the national communities between different countries and also globally, but also in terms of the, let's call it the enlightened self-interest. We need to cooperate because a pandemic, I mean, the virus does not look at the flags before infecting people. The virus goes on. And we have to commit. By the way, that's going to be a very important issue. The moment a vaccine is discovered, and I hope it will be, and it's able to be manufactured, that we have fair system of distribution all over the world and not just for the richer countries. Now, in Europe, I think the role of the European institutions is critical. And by the way, they try to act, to be fair. For instance, at the beginning of the crisis, there were some announcements made by some countries, including in terms of making difficult the circulation of goods, including food, for instance. And it was the European Commission that acted to prevent some problems in the internal market. Afterwards, of course, there were, but that is fully justified, there were some restrictions in freedom of movement inside the European Union, because when there is a pandemic, of course, the national health authorities have the right, I would say sometimes they have the duty to decide on some closing of borders. But that was not a specifically European Union issue, as you know. In the United States, there are now problems to go from some states to the other. In the United Kingdom, just one country. The reality is that the government announces everyday measures, but it's for England, because Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales, they have different. And even the times of lockdown and the policy have been different in the same country. And that is to some extent justified, because decisions have to be taken closer to the citizens. Now, but I think the European institutions basically are now showing a relatively high level of perception of a common interest. The decisions taken by the European Central Bank, by the European Commission, so far by the Eurogroup and the European Council, even with a lot of discussion and polarizing debates, but at the end there comes an agreement. So I hope that will continue. But we have to understand the European Union, I've been making that point for many years, as something that is by definition incremental. We are not a state. We are not the United States of Europe. And by the way, I believe that we are not going to be in the near future. And so it's... So you have to understand progress, by the way, is step by step. That was, by the way, already considered like that when the European Community was founded by after the La Déclaration Schuman, the Schuman Declaration, and so on. So, but it's true that when we have a crisis, we need step by step, but a bigger step. And now, and this is the point, are we now ready for a bigger step in European integration? I hope we are. And there is a lot to do, not only to approve this recovery plan, but also to fill the gaps of the European Economic and Monetary Union. For instance, the banking union that it was in fact initiated by my commission, there were three pillars, two have been adopted immediately, but there is still one missing. It's very important for the completion of the Economic and Monetary Union to have a common deposit guarantee scheme. For instance, now to have a capital markets union. but also beyond economic matters, to have, for instance, a more coordinated approach to foreign policy and defense and security matters. I think that's the trend. Also because our leaders, generally speaking, in Europe, they have understood that even the biggest countries, even the biggest country in Europe from an economic point of view, Germany, or one other of the biggest countries, France, that is, after Britain left the European Union, France is the only European Union permanent member of the Security Council. Even those two countries understand that on their own, and with all the respect for them, they are not in the same league of influence as the United States or China. That's the reality. I've seen that in my own experience in the G20. I mean, our country, if Europe does not appear united, it will not be relevant. As simple as that. I'm being very brutal, but that's the reality. Today in this world, size matters. And if you want to protect our interests and also to promote our values, it's obvious that Europeans have to act together, either through the European Union, also working other. By the way, when I speak about Europe, I also continue to include Britain, even if they are outside of the European Union, or Switzerland, or Norway, or other countries that are extremely important for Europe, because in fact they are like mine. They are, in fact, some of these countries are more integrated in the European Union from an economic point of view than some European Union countries. That's the reality. For instance, if you look at Switzerland from a point of view of trade or investment, it's completely integrated in the European Union economically, not, of course, at the level of institutions. So we need to act together if we want to keep our specific way of life, our open societies, our open economies. And this is broadly understood. The question now is how to take the decisions. And as I've said before, typically in the European Union, those decisions take time. Sometimes it's frustratingly slow. It's incremental. It's muddling through. I don't like very much the word, but that's the way it is. But I continue to think that at the end of the day, the forces of integration are stronger than the ones of disintegration. And typically, we have at the end some form of compromise or consensus.
You've brought me really well to the last question that I had from you. You touched on the UN Security Council, and we haven't talked much about the EU's common foreign and security policy. And of course, before the pandemic, there was already a really large number of challenges on that front. There was the ongoing war in Syria, there's the migration crisis, there's a whole host of armed conflicts in sub-Saharan Africa, there's problems of Russia, cyber, nuclear, and so on. How do you feel that the pandemic is going to influence all of these concerns? Do you think that when we come out of this, the geopolitical considerations will be different? Of course, there could be some opportunities for change. Do you see any positives coming out of it on this front?
Yeah, I mean, just as we have said before, even before the crisis, there were already some trends on that direction. It's not by chance, it's for some reason that now, for instance, we are using expressions like European sovereignty. By the way, President Macron speaks a lot about this idea of European sovereignty. Strategic autonomy, that is an expression that is in the document of the European Union on common foreign and security policy, I mean, external relations of the European Union. So the idea of strategic autonomy. And also, for instance, the new president of the Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, spoke about a more geopolitical commission. So the idea that Europe has to be more political, more geopolitical, that Europe should not only follow or mainly follow, let's say, an economic logic when looks at the world outside, but it should be more, let's say, less naive, more aware of some geopolitical challenges. And this, I think, has come gradually. When I was in office, I was calling the attention of our member states for that. At that time, I remember, for instance, in Britain, the British at that time wanted a free trade agreement with China. And they were criticizing the European Commission because it was too protectionist from their point of view. Of course, we could not make a free trade agreement with China. By the way, we proposed China, and it's still being discussed now, after all these years, an investment agreement so that we could have a level playing field. So my point is that we have to be less naive, and we have to look at these foreign security issues in a more coordinated way. There is progress on that area. those initiatives from so-called permanent structured cooperation. I think today also, and by paradoxical reasons, Europeans are more, let's say, are contemplating much more seriously progress in terms of common defense, or at least common policy, defense policy. And I would say a little bit provocatively, I would say basically for because of Putin and because of Trump, which is a very interesting. After the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, the Europeans, some become more than others, but they aware of the need to protect themselves more in defense terms. But also a point made by President Trump, and it was not only him. I remember listening in many NATO meetings I participated. That was the same point made by Obama, by George W. Bush, even by Clinton. In all summits I was in NATO, I remember the President of the United States asking Europe to spend more, European countries to spend more in defense. The difference now is that President Trump makes it in his very idiosyncratic way. But that is a constant point. And now the Europeans are doing it. So I think it's a fair point the Americans have. If you wanted to have a stronger defense, you should pay also for it. And that's what now Europe is doing. And also because of the concerns that now come because of China and the volatility of geopolitical situation. And you mentioned some points in our very our neighborhood from Libya to Syria, from the issue of refugees. There are a lot of concerns, political, geopolitical, security, and in defense terms that Europeans have to consider. So, but once again, I don't expect that's going to be tomorrow a kind of a Philadelphia moment, a United States of Europe in the field of defense. But I expect Europeans gradually to become more determined and to act together in these matters.
Well, we've run out of time. By way of a very quick summary, I think what you've left us with is surprisingly and refreshingly quite a positive view going forward. Of course, as you acknowledge, the challenges are monumental, of the likes we've never seen before, even in your extensive experience. But as you say, there is hope for change economically, politically, socially. And the takeaways I took from what you said is that we need to learn a little bit better from history, take a long-sighted view and work together better. As you said, only by being unified do we have a hope moving forward. And so notwithstanding the challenges presented by the China-US relationship and the wider crisis in global governance, the EU has a really important role here in striving for a stronger multilateralism and contributing wherever it can in the world. So once again, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you back in Geneva when travel resumes.
I'll be delighted. Thank you very much for your excellent summary, by the way, and also for the very good dialogue. Thank you.
That was José Manuel Barroso discussing the role of Europe in working towards a stronger multilateralism in times of COVID-19 with Erika Moret. For more information about the Graduate Institute, please visit graduateinstitute.ch. I'm Lena Menge. Thanks for listening.